You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, troll on in. Hopefully catch them or learn about catching them. And one of the things we're going to do today, unfortunately for some of you meat hunters, is we're going to tag some fish and release them back into the wild to give us vital statistical information that is needed to make all kinds of decisions. And some of you have heard us in the past talking about the Papio Tagging Project and OEO and some of the other things. Today, we're going to grasp into some pelagic, some big open ocean fish, the yellowfin tuna, the ahi, and also the striped marlin, the stripey. And, you know, some of you fishermen would be hard-pressed to do what these folks do all the time, and that's tag them and then let them go to give information instead of giving a couple of bucks into the wallet or more importantly, you know, feeding the family. So with that in mind, what is this information all about and what is it used for? You know that we've done the inshore ones a bit. Now it's time to go, and this is because of the Pacific Island Fisheries Group undertaking these wonderful projects. One of them is a year, the other one's a couple years. And we're gonna begin by introducing you to part of the folks that are involved in this. First of all, from here in Hawaii, he's the project manager and investigator is Clayward Tam. Clay has been involved in the fishery for a long time, and this must make you, Clay, pretty proud of being part of this project.
Oh yes.
How did you get hooked in? I mean, you know, what was your original? Okay, I want to be a part of that.
Coming from a fishing background,
mm-hmm.
I had the interest in a little bit of science, so I was hooked on it.
Were you surprised, not just at the way that you can do these things, but at how valuable at the other end the information that you gather is?
Well, definitely. And with today's technology and tools, information is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Our other guest today is a scientist from as far away from Hawaii as you can be and still be in the United States, Dr. Molly Lutkovich. She is... spends a lot of time in Gloucester, where we've had the guys on from Wicked Tuna. She knows all those guys. But also for you, Molly, it's sort of an interesting, I'm sure, circuitous route that brought you to the Pacific. How did that happen? What was your original interest in this whole subject anyway?
Well, I'm a scientist that has known Hawaiian large pelagic scientists that were affiliated with what was known as the Pacific Research Program, PFRP,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of focus on tuna science there, and also I've been a member of a scientific committee, WESPAC, Science and Statistical
sure.
Committee, for over 10 years now.
You know, the thing I find incredibly interesting, and that's why we bring in, you know, the other neck of the woods, Gloucester, is because I would imagine that some of these bluefin, you almost know them by name. I mean, you know, I mean, it is to a point now where, first of all, everybody always asks, is the quota system as brutal as it is? I mean, is it real? Do they really enforce it? Do they stop fishing when they catch so many fish?
Absolutely. Mm. It's bluefin is one of the most highly regulated fish in the ocean.
Yeah.
And but the good news is that through the science and the partnerships that we've had, we've actually, with science, changed the view of what the population status really is. And that led to an increase in quota.
Yeah, I was going to say, what this is, I don't want anybody out there to think that these projects are designed to lessen your ability to catch your fish. And quite often they reveal information that is so dramatically different than what was previously perceived as. You can open, in some respects, Clay, that's kind of what happened in the bottom fishery, right?
That's true.
They took a look at these stocks and they said, hey, you know, there's plenty, so let's increase the catch a little bit. Now, of course, we all went out and caught them, so they're reducing a little bit. Are you comfortable that the fishermen understand a little bit what's going on?
I think so. Through our Bought a Fish Cooperative Research Project with NOAA. We've been working with fishermen for the last 6 years, and them being part of the process and understanding and sharing, not only gathering the data, but the outcome of the data has been a really interesting process, and I think, you know, valuable to the fishery.
You know, one thing is anecdotal evidence, but the other thing, and I wish this was TV today, gang, because, and maybe you can see some of this on the WP Council website later on when we air this segment, and we'll have some photos for you, is the equipment and the way it's used. But also, I think, Molly, if we go and take a look at something that I mentioned sort of comedically off the air, is that it's pretty easy to do a stock assessment, say, on a reef, because you go out there and you look. And, you know, you get some local talent that say, well, here's where they are this time of the year, here's where they are that time of the year. Is it a different deal when you start taking a look at pelagics, which go many, 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 many miles sometimes?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why there's been so much of a challenge of how many tuna are there, because highly migratory fish like tunas, like ahi and bluefin, the only time we see them, for the most part, until these new technologies, is when they're caught. Yeah. And so only fish that are caught can be counted. And so population estimates were based on things like catch per unit effort. And in the case of the tunas, when you talk to the old timers that understand the biology of the fish, they always said, how could that capture fish that are so highly migratory? And that's what led us to start to improve the science with fishery independent tools.
What I think is fascinating is the intercooperation and sometimes lack thereof in certain places in the Pacific, where there's an argument about whose fish are these. And I mean, are they migrating from here, migrating from there? I'm interested in already anecdotally what you've been able to determine out of the fish that have been tagged. How far they can actually roam, and how many different... They don't know what district it is. They just go where they're going to go, right?
That's right. There have been a few tags on fish in the main Hawaiian Islands, and it was tantalizing that some of those fish traveled from one island to the next. But with our preliminary tagging, one fish tag for 53 days that we released with our partners off Kauai, in 53 days that ahi ran down to the Big Island and back, the tag came off north of Kauai. But who would have ever suspected that say about a month that a fish would run down and back? And so that just clued us into, when we keep tags on a year, it's going to be so exciting to see what the fish do.
You know, Clay, when we first met years ago, a lot of us were looking at what was called the Papahanaumokuakea Reserve. And there was many, many people here in Hawaii, locally, that thought, well, these fish, that's the nursery. They're all coming from over there, the ahi or the veki or whatever. That's a pretty far trip. And so does some of this information that you guys are looking at with the ahi project, does it cement into pretty much fact that in the main Hawaiian Islands, we have our own ahi population? Some is not migratory, some are born and die here?
Based on some of the research that's been done, like through with Dave Aitano of them, through local tagging efforts, it has shown that. The question comes in with lines up with this project is, what are the adults doing? Where are the big fish going?
Fishermen, because they're not afraid of anything. They're just going to go.
Right. Fishermen, we see them come through during the summer, the big ahi run, and then they're gone. So the big question is, where do they go?
Where do they go? Right. Exactly. Yeah. But I think that maybe part of that, and Molly, your expertise would be very valuable here, is that when we talk in the past of tags, it was a physical tag. And when that fish would get caught, if it had the tagging information on, you could tell a little something. This stuff that you're using today is high tech. And what you're doing is being able to get fantastic amounts of information from a fish.
That's right. And my lab is the Large Pelagics Research Center, which is pretty much done 17, 18 years worth of research on the giant bluefin tuna. Mm-hmm. And we were about the second group in using these high-tech pop-up satellite tags. And what we found the first year that we put them out with our fishermen partners is that giant bluefin tuna did not do what they were supposed to do.
In fact, they weren't behaving.
Yeah. And that really clued us into all kinds of questions about what we could learn by finally having a way to track fish for a long time. And I'd say in the last 17 years, we've basically turned over bluefin science base. We turned over the understanding of the biology and brought it back to actually some of the insights and best intuition of the old best bluefin fishermen.
Yeah, that's terrific. And I think that it appears to me that there's a working relationship, almost like a marriage, between the anecdotal stuff that the fisherman will tell you and what your equipment will say. And maybe when the two meet, then vital, valuable statistics can be created.
That's right.
Is that good?
That's good. And it's not just statistics. It's actually the most basic aspects of biology. Where do they go? Where do they spawn? Mm-hmm. What do they eat? And that's what's lacking for a lot of these highly migratory species.
It's hard, Clay, if we take a look at traditionally how we catch small tuna, ahi, I mean, the shibi and the little oi oi and little things. Those fish, there's no way that little fish can say go to Guam, because it's going to get eaten by 15 things on its way, right? But what about the answer? What about the fishermen that say, okay, well, if it's true there's this big run in June and July, where do they go?
Right, correct.
Well, what are we finding? Where do they go?
Oh, that's what we want to find out now.
Yeah, yeah.
With having Molly out here in the Pacific and with their expertise. That's some of the questions that we hope to answer with the project and with support and help from our fishing community. And
okay.
Hopefully we'll have the answers.
I want to make sure that there's a couple of things. First of all, when we talk about the Ahi and the striped marlin project, they're different, but they're in lots of similarities. And I don't know about in your part of the world's fishery, Molly, about small marlin, small billfish, but stripies here were always kind of like undesirable. And then all of a sudden they became a fashionable thing to eat, and now they're sought. What's the parallel universe of the striped marlin tagging project? What's that for?
Well, what's interesting is striped marlin is very important to places like Japan, where mm-hmm. they're really food. And the concern is, the question is, what's the relationship of the central North Pacific, the main Hawaiian Islands, striped marlin? Because when overfishing is occurring, when assessment scientists say striped marlin are overfished in the Northwest Pacific, if they're managed Pacific-wide, what happens for the overall Pacific management affects Hawaiian fishermen and families. And so the goal is, what's the relationship of the main Hawaiian Islands and the region striped marlin to the rest of the Pacific? And we need to know that to know how can we make sure that striped marlin remains a resource for the main Hawaiian Islands.
The thing that is of interest is these are two different studies. The Ahi project is a one-year project. Is that correct?
Funded for 1 year
so far. And the striped marlin project by design is longer than that, Clay?
Yeah, for 2 years.
You know, are you surprised? First of all, stripies, it looks like they can travel over greater distances than ahi, but I'm not sure of that either. Is there any indication? Do we have our own supply of stripies, or do we rely on the pelagic nature of the fish?
That's another question that needs to be answered. But I think Tim Lamb, who works at Molly and had recently published a paper about that, and some of the information is in there, and it describes different segments based on preliminary tagging data that Hawaii seems to be a mixing pot of fish maybe from California and other adults from other parts of the Pacific. So this tag centric area that we're looking at, and to hopefully place tags to better answer that question, and then we can probably look toward better stock assessment in that area.
The thing that interests me of most, though, Molly, is your toys. The technical nature of the equipment that you're using. It's not just a tag with a number on it that you compare to a list. It's pretty sophisticated, and I'm guessing that it's merely decades old, if that, that this is an evolving science. For those that can't see the neat toys that you brought into the studio, what sort of a tag is placed, say, on this yellowfin tuna, on the ahi, and what do you get from it after it's placed?
The tags are called pop-up satellite archival tags. And imagine putting a little computer on your fish that has sensors on it that can record pressure for depth, temperature, and light levels. And actually, it's the light levels that if you're a mariner or a celestial navigator, a simple way to say it is that we use the amount of light, an estimate of sunrise and sunset and day length, to assign latitude and latitude for that day. And so the tags are meant to record temperature and depth and light. And when they finally pop up, hopefully after as long as a year, they transmit that data to receivers on orbiting satellites.
Yeah, see, that's the part I want to make sure that everybody gets. By the nature of the pop-up, this isn't your little pop-up food cart down at Ala Moana Friday night. This is a unbelievably sophisticated device that I don't even know how we can afford to do this, but I know that's probably another story. We need more of them. But what happens is, at a certain point in time, this detaches from the fish that it's on. It pops up to the surface and it transmits its scoop, which means this little egg-like looking thing is pretty magic. It absorbs a lot of data.
It does, and you can guess that, like any perb, when it starts transmitting, you know, sometimes the technology doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's a 1996 technology. In the middle of that tag, it started as a bird transmitter.
Oh boy.
That's the heart of the transmitter. And, you know, the truth is, at $4,000 a piece, it's really hard to raise the money for projects to put out a lot, because sometimes the reporting rate can be challenging.
Yeah.
It's like any other device that goes out into the ocean. So what we'd like to see after 17 years is the next kind of tag for the technology. But
yeah, that's coming, I'm hoping. But see, I think that what's important to note is this, little tag or this little computer is doing its job, and then it starts to transmit. But that doesn't mean that a United Airlines flight going by picks this up. There's arrangements made with, is it a French company?
It's called Service Argos, and it's basically, they're a data distribution center. They're the people that ocean buoys that get
buoy wind information. Sure.
It's the same, and so they're worldwide, and the receivers are on NOAA satellites that fly over the world. There are 5 or 6 satellites, and we pay for the data as well. So when you fund these projects, you have to pay not only for the $4,000 piece, you pay for the data, and then hopefully you have partnerships that allow us to get out there in the ocean without a research vessel. And that's where fishermen are absolutely part of this deal.
Yeah, and that's the other side of the coin, because I do know that every now and again, Clay, one of these things shows up. But basically, you must feel part of a bigger picture when you can do this, because it looks like without good data, there's going to be decisions made by people up the food chain from us that affect what we can catch, how often we can, what size limits are, what bag limits are, and all of this other kind of stuff. And do they know in Washington and at federal fisheries that we're different here, that sometimes we sell, sometimes we just eat, sometimes we don't pay attention to size because we're hungry?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, Mike. And I think that locally, as a fishing community out in the Pacific, where we rely on the resource of food, I think it's an important point, and that it is of great value, even more value than just money. When it comes down to sharing with our community, our culture, heritage, it's our fisheries are what we are out in the Pacific.
We often talk here, and I'm sure, Molly, you've heard this already, that at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, we call ourselves Ground Up. That the information coming off the beaches and off the reefs is valuable to the inshore fishery, but the outshore fishery, we leave it to the commercial bottom guys, to the weekend warriors, the trollers, and certainly the longline fleet. Just so when you say funding, so that people understand, this is a NOAA project, and NOAA gets a lot of help from a lot of people, including you, Clay, and the Pacific Island Fisheries Group. I'm not sure any of what they do would be possible if it wasn't for the number of outside players that are involved.
Absolutely. And as a university professor at UMass, we have always been basically the people that are pushing innovation for the agency to say, look, you need better information, not just catches. And so sometimes it's a hard sell, but once you establish that the information can help their assessments, then I think they're on board. But a lot of times, as you can tell, sometimes it's a fisherman that brings the need to us as the scientists and PFG. And in the case of the Atlantic, we went after bluefin. It all started with fishermen saying, we need much better information.
Yeah, by the way, we're going broke. Our kids have no desire to be part of the family business because 6 months into the season, we have to stop fishing or whatever. And maybe not. Maybe we are stronger. But there's no – I guess if you take a look and you go back to, like, the perfect storm and you see the sword boats and everything else, that there's no question that technology in some areas, Molly – did outfish the resource. In other words, we developed the ability to catch more fish than the ocean could give us.
Well, in the case of large pelagics, one of the most highly regulated fisheries in the world, there's a perception sometimes that it's overfished, but you're absolutely right. In many cases, fish are overfished, but I think we have to change the perception or the media or the ideologue story that tunas are on the brink of extinction. And as a scientist, it's been harder lately to push against the myths that are sometimes advocated
I'm really worried about that. I think you're right. And I think that our listeners learn every time we talk about this. Because I think that, you know, Clay, we the late Mike Sakamoto is a great example. They still show the PSA of him kissing an omilo and putting it back in the water because, you know, let it grow for tomorrow. But in actual fact, some of us don't have that luxury. We can't wait for tomorrow because our families and stuff are hungry today. So it looks like some of this information is actually working maybe on behalf of us, that we can catch maybe once the statistical data is compiled, that we can catch a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think that's hopefully what the data shows. And, you know, for us here in the islands, it's important to satisfy what we need as food. But, you know, as we learn now, it's And it's better to eat fish fresh. So what we do in Catch Extra, you know, to put one or two back for tomorrow is important.
Yeah, especially taking lines out of the water when you've caught 14 chibi. And, you know, how many can you really give away? And how many people say, well, you got to cut it and clean it. No, no, no. I'm going to let this fish become an ahi. I think that being said, that it must bring, pride to everybody that's sort of involved in getting the right results. I am sort of worried that there are certain groups that really don't have the right science. We hear so much, like you said, Molly, that a lot of fishermen feel that they're guilty. They shouldn't feel guilty. You know, it's an honorable profession. It's a hard living to make, but, you know, being able to substantiate the catch. So let's talk about the physicality of it. Explain a little bit more about this device, and more importantly, how they are put on the fish. Where do you go? Do you catch them on the line? Let's tag a 150-pound ahi today.
Well, Clay and I are enjoying the benefits.
You get to do it.
Of our 17 years of R&D mm-hmm. with Atlantic bluefin fishermen, and I've had the great luxury of having some of the best fishermen in the Atlantic fleet as my partners. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, we haven't talked about how challenging it was to even, as Mike, you could see, there's a tether that we attach this device to the fish, and there's a dart, and we've actually tested trial and error and all kinds of things to come up with the most compatible attachment for the fish to do the least harm on the fish, mm-hmm. and even handling, say, an 800-pound giant bluefin swimming alongside, or even tagging with a harpoon tagging pole or releasing from a purse seine. I've worked with the three types of fishery and longliners in mm-hmm. the Atlantic. So what we're able to bring to the Pacific with PFGI is actually based on 17 years of at-sea trial and error and coming up with the best possible approaches. And that has allowed us to keep our tags on for up to 1 year.
Yes,
and that's pretty good.
Let me tell you what I'm seeing here with my eyes, and I would show you this. I'm going to take a picture of it and put it online, put it on the web or something. But what this is it's a dart. It's an extremely sharp dart, and right near it is attached to the tag, and there's a sort of sophisticated look barb. If you had an old single, you know, shaft spear, it had that little metal barb on it. This is sort of like that, so it goes far enough into the skin of the fish to deploy. I mean, so when it comes back, it won't come out.
Yeah, basically you're aiming for the fin ray bones on the mm-hmm. on the fish to lock into the bone structure, and it's like an upside down umbrella without the cloth, mm-hmm. and it hooks on to the fin ray bones, and that anchors into the fish.
It's kind of like those of you that go out ikashibi, or those of you that go out and catch shrimp, you'll know that little barb thing. It's one way. It goes in easy, but doesn't come out.
Right.
Okay. Now that being said. It's still tenuous, difficult. I mean, when you guys tag them, so how, like right now, the ahi that are getting tagged, are they getting released from line, or a combination of things?
Basically, our four fish that were tagged out of Kauai were from trolling boats. Mm-hmm. So
in other words, the fishermen, like Molly said, you become friends with fishermen. They had to give this fish a big Mike Sakamoto kiss and let it go, right?
Correct.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's not as though you can go out and we're going to go tag 10 ahi today. Because I'm surprised, Molly. One thing you said, this thing, the device is about $4,000 a pop. I don't think that's a lot. I mean, I know it is a lot, but in actual fact, 30 years ago, it would have been $40,000, not four. So we are getting to the point, I guess, where is it possible to upgrade the technology? Is that something else that's been looked at?
Well, you know that biomedical devices and, you know, your exercise
count exponentially growing, right?
Absolutely. So, and you know, the more tags on, the better. And the other thing we found out from bluefin is, you know, bluefin don't all do the same thing. They're mm-hmm. really complex. And so there are so many surprises from the first data that came in. And we're expecting the same in the Pacific with the ahi and marlins.
Just so that people can understand, when we take a look at the Wicked Tuna, our audience knows we've had all of the guys that you know, all of these crazy characters on the show on a regular basis. Although it's a reality show, it's still very meaningful for us. But it shows that their fish are a little bit different than our yellowfin. They're not in the huge schools. They are more independent. In other words, when you go to a pinnacle or one of their marks or one of their spots, Are there plenty of fish there for them to catch, or are they looking for strays, or is both true?
They're both true, and in fact, where we started, bluefin have large schools, and we started with aerial surveys, and giant bluefin can form schools upwards of 4,000 to 5,000 fish just at the surface. Mm-hmm. Over the last decade, they've been smaller and breaking up, and there's been a lot of change with ocean warming. But absolutely, so sometimes schools can have 4 or 5 giants. They call them soldiers.
Yeah.
And occasionally, we have done a lot of work with aerial surveys with schools upwards of maybe even 5,000 or 6,000 to 7,000 giants.
Yeah, it's amazing, Clay. Every now and again, people don't understand this. Even Ulua do that sometimes, where you can't believe there's this big pile of Ulua where you would think of them as strays. I think, don't most people here think that when you get into an ahi run, it's because there's really plenty? And the ones on the surface that you can get on your lure, that's just the tip of the iceberg. The big fish are underneath.
Right, you're right.
Yeah.
And usually you'll see that. Even now today with depth recorders, if you're running them, it's just like wicked tuna. You see them under the boat as you troll over.
You know, there was that concern, and I'm sure, Molly, because of where you come from, you already know this, that our equipment has become more and more sophisticated. Like when I was a kid, if you wanted to go out and find a pinnacle, you had to use the old man's landmarks. And he had a way of, and if it was cloudy, you couldn't find it because you needed the mountain and the peak and the coconut tree. Now you need a thing that even duh me can go to the same place back and forth. So sometimes the equipment is also to blame for us being more on the fish, right? I mean, you know, the better equipment, the more fish we catch.
That's true, but in the case of large pelagics like a tuna, it still has to bite. And what's interesting is fishermen...
Wrong color. Whoops.
They didn't want us, particularly spotter pilots, didn't want us to say, you know, where the fish were photographed. But, you know, the truth is the fish is at least rarely there the next day. Mm-hmm. It might be back there a year later, but they always move. And that's why fishermen have to be good at figuring that out.
Okay, so what's the, on this, before we run out of time, what's the prognosis on, let's talk first about the ahi tagging project. At what point is it, Clay? And where does it need to go to get completed? And then hopefully the value, the info will be so valuable to say, okay, now let's do this on a bigger scale.
Okay, right now we're just getting started with the second round of PSAT tagging. Mm-hmm. But we're also going to implement the volunteer tagging with the spaghetti or the dart tags for our volunteer anglers. You know, if you're out there, you catch a few enough to take home, and tag they're one. Biting good. You know, tag one or two would be a great help to the program. And
what is also a bigger help to that is if you are so lucky as to catch one of these fish, to understand the value of what you've got.
Right, exactly. And those who recover the fish, we offer a T-shirt reward.
Got him a T-shirt.
Yeah. More important, we'll give you the information of where it was actually tagged and also growth rates.
I can't believe how many people now will call the show or email me from the buck stops here in the Hawaii Boats and Yachts that I do, and they're so proud that their kid is now up to 100 papillo. Where before, right, they used to go in a bucket and go home, and sometimes they didn't get eaten. And nowadays, do you find, Molly, at our end of the spectrum that we are hungry birds in the nest with regards to wanting the info to make clear, informed decisions about how our fisheries should be handled or managed?
Absolutely. And I think, Mike, the word is passionate. And what drives us, it's hard work sometimes, but working together with fishermen and sharing the passion for getting better information. We call it science, whether it's science or not. But as Clay said, too, we the next step for us will be hosting more workshops and distributing tags on all of the islands. And so stay tuned. Pitchy will be letting everybody know when you can come down and meet us and get some tag kits.
Yeah, and hopefully that's going to happen in the next Council Fishers Forum. I want to tell you that a lot of what we're talking about here, you can go to the WP Council website, wpcouncil.org, and you can type in or go search the Ahi Tagging Project or the Stripe Marlin Tagging Project. I want to talk for a minute here, Molly, about the stripies, because this is an area which I think that people can really, really kind of relate to in a ways, because not only the way the fish is spectacular, but when you get one, you get barrage. Sometimes you get lit up 4 or 5 on the hook at the same time. This is a fast-moving pelagic surface-running game fish. I mean, isn't it sort of interesting what these things do? But do they also go deep?
Well, to be honest, we don't have striped marlin in the Atlantic, so I'm learning. I think of sailfish, which we work on, but the marlins are not as, they don't travel as deep as the tunas, and we already know that. None of them do, but they can go to 300 meters, mm-hmm. and they make trips
down there. That's 900 feet, folks. That's pretty deep.
Yeah. To chase their bait, and but they're not traveling as deeply as the ahi or big eye or bluefin tuna, but they're still pretty deep.
You know, I can tell you, Clay, more than anecdotally, and I'm sure you can add to this too, that they're really pesky little guys. You know, they you're out trying to catch ahi or something, and all of a sudden a bunch of stripies come knocking around your lures. But they're smart; they don't get hooked up. They knock you down, but they don't stick a lot. And when they do, I guess now they certainly are delicious. We've learned that a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, definitely. And yet, like you said, they do come in schools, and it seems to be seasonal. Certain years will be better years than others. Definitely.
But I'm hoping that some of this information, I mean, I want to go back to, we explained a little bit. I want to go back to more or less, Molly, you explaining how these fishermen have the ability to go find the fish that you need to get the tags put on. Is it a pretty interesting dance when the fish comes into the boat? They don't want to be there. Obviously, they're not going to gaff them. So what do you do to this fish to simmer it down a little bit so you can stick your tag in it?
Well, with the giant bluefin, we don't bring them in the boat. Mm-hmm. So we've had to develop, the fishermen have basically heavy tackle, making sure the boat's in motion. And I mean, they're really, really good at swimming alongside. Mm-hmm. In the case of the smaller fish, we bring them through the tuna door, put them on a padded vinyl, cover mm-hmm. their eyes, and it's a lot easier with the small fish and a tuna door. But
don't try this at home, folks.
Yeah,
you have to kind of know what you're doing a little bit.
You have to know what you're doing. But together we've worked it out, and we're going to do the same with our ahi fishermen here.
Okay, so and Pacific Island Fisheries Group is a great way to get more information. It looks to me, Molly, even though you're, you know, thousands of miles away from your university and your students, that you're going to bring something back to them. How long are you staying in Hawaii?
Well, I now have a base in Kauai, mm-hmm. and with these projects, I expect to spend an awful lot of time here, and Clay and I have a lot to do with our partners and get these fish tagged.
Well, I hope you can come back again down the road with some of the results of some of these projects. Very nice meeting you. And Clay, always a pleasure hooking up with you, too. That's going to do it for this version of the program. I want to remind you, because of the Pacific, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, you can go online and you can see more and more of what we do and more importantly, what's happening. And if you want to hear something on the show, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@aol.com. themikebuckshow@aol.com. So we'll see you next time. In the meantime, keep an eye out. I got a big expose coming up in next month's The Buck Stops Here column about the deplorable condition of some of our harbors and boat ramps. And maybe we've got to spend a little bit more time on that. More coming up. See you next week. Tight lines to everybody.